Mr. Don Hitchcock, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Hitchcock?
I was born on the 15th of November at a quarter to midnight in North Lancashire in the Valley of the Lune at a place called Melling. Melling simply was a nursing home. My family lived in Hornby. My father was a railway signalman in those days on the main line from Leeds, Bradford to Morecambe. I had two older brothers. The eldest one, sadly for him, was born in Yorkshire. Well, the second one was born in Yorkshire as well, both in a place called Eccleshill. My oldest brother, Bill, is 85 now, and my next in line is 84. They've weathered fairly well, but obviously they're beginning to feel the years. But nonetheless, I had a very excellent upbringing, and we soon moved from Hornby to a place called Belbusk, which was on the main line from Leeds to Carlisle. They call it the Settle Carlisle line now.
Belbusk?
Belbusk.
Busk.
Busk, with a K. And we lived in the railway cottages. My father must have been upwardly mobile as far as the railway was concerned in those days, because we soon moved again to Cone in Lancashire. And again, we lived in a railway house, but not for long. So when I was three, we had moved from Hornby to Belbusk. Belbusk is near Malham. It's in the heart of the country, near Gargrave, Skipton, that area. And then we moved a little further on, which seemed to be hundreds of miles to me as a small child, into Cone in Lancashire. In Cone, we lived for 1 year in a railway house in a strange place called Rigby Street. It seemed to me, as a child, to be at the bottom of a cliff. That was the embankment of the railway line. My father bought a house in a place called Parker Street, which was on the fringe of the town. In those days, Cone, which was a small manufacturing town, a cotton town, specializing in what they called fancies. Those were the high-grade cloths, woven cloths. Cone was, I suppose, a very ancient town. It had an old center, and it hadn't spread much when I was a very small child. It has spread a little since then, but it is basically the same. The biggest change to Cone came when I was quite young, in the 1930s, and this was called the Slum Clearance Scheme, where Cone, like many other places, got rid of its finest buildings. And it widened the main street. In other words, destroyed the medieval quality of the town. Today, it could have been replaced, it could have been restored, and we could have had a medieval town. There are a few medieval buildings left. As a small child, then, I was brought up in Cone, in a place called Parker Street, not far from an allotment which led on to the railway. My father was a railway signalman, and he worked shifts. I was quite accustomed to the railway. I wasn't quite one of the railway children, but nonetheless, I did have a lot to do with the railway at that time. And we used to travel, because my father had free passes on the railway, we used to travel northwards to where he had come from originally, which was up in Cumbria. So his mother and father, and I remember my grandfather equally being a railwayman, he was a signalman on the Settle Carlisle line at a place called Newbiggin. Newbiggin is between Appleby and Carlisle. And as a small child, going there was absolutely wonderful. There was a beck called the Crowdundle Beck coming down off Cross Fell. There were hills, mountains, there were wild animals, and it had a very formative effect on my life. I cannot forget the joys of that area, and I can remember it vividly. Equally, my mother had her parents alive, and she came from a large family also, as did my father. There were about nine in the family, but these were rather grim people. They lived in a place called Greengates in Yorkshire, which was just south of Bradford. And my grandfather had started work at about 8 years of age. His antecedents were pretty horrible, Dickensian. He worked at eight, sweeping on the looms in the factories. And that was his job. He was illiterate. And the stories that were told by my mother, of course, in those days, there was not much recording, there was no TV, no film. Everything was by word of mouth. And so I grew up in a rich oral history. And I could go on for weeks talking about the things that my mother told me about my grandfather's background. He was an interesting man because he never really went to school. And when he got married at the age of about 17, he was illiterate. He'd moved then from sweeping under looms to being a blacksmith striker. Later on, he became a blacksmith. Later on, he had his own foundry. He was, again, upwardly mobile in the modern terminology. He was a typical Victorian entrepreneur. And he made a lot of money. He was passionately devoted to education. He thought education was just the thing. And I asked him, as a small child, "Why, Grandad, do you like education?" He said, "Hey, lad," he said, "if I'd only been educated, I'd have made a lot more money."
So it was a happy childhood.
Fascinating childhood, I think. It was really formative, highly formative. And I was brought up knowing about engineering, knowing about factories, because Cone was a mill town. Equally, I was known to care for the countryside.
Now, what about your education? Tell us a bit about that. What schools did you attend?
The age of five, I can remember the very day. The day after my birthday, so it will be the 16th of November, I went to Lord Street Council School, the junior section. And I remember walking in there, where I met another lad who also went in the Navy. He was a telegraphist later on in life, Frank Wilkinson, who was exactly born on the same day as myself. So when we had, in that school, birthday celebrations, he and I had to share the badge which said that today is your birthday. And because he was nominally older than me, he got it first. So he had it for the morning and I had it for the afternoon. Anyway, from Parker Street, Lord Street Council School wasn't far. My two brothers were in the upper part of the school. There was a big section there marked boys and another section marked girls. The girls went in one door, the boys went in the other. But the girls shared the playground with the infant school, the primary school. I graduated into the big school. And in those days, you had the class teacher who taught you everything. There was no streaming. You learnt arithmetic. You learnt mental arithmetic. You learnt things which people never teach now. And you learnt to spell. You also had story times. And I remember one particular teacher, Miss Whittaker, who was very keen on talking about the wind in the willows. And I always had a fond spot for the wind in the willows ever since. And so she used to read us at the end of the afternoon little snippets from the wind in the willows as a kind of a listening with mother. I went from that school because in those days you could get scholarships to the grammar school, but I went from there to another school which was about a mile and a half away, called the Central School. This was for those who could pass exams. It was a kind of in-between school. And most kids at that time finished their education either in the upper class of Lord Street Council School, which was where the dross ended up, or you went to the Central School, where sometimes you were prime for going into the factories. Very rarely did you get into clerking jobs from the Central School. I lived through the Depression. I remember the mills closing. I remember people walking around. I remember beggars in the town. I remember my grandfather, the one from the countryside in the north, coming to live in Cone in 1936 when he retired from the railway, handing his overcoat, the only one he got, to a beggar in the street. And my father said to him, "What are you doing that for?" He said, "Well," he said, "poor chap, I haven't got any clothes, hardly. And he's cold."
How did you do at school then? You know, what subjects did you like? How did you do?
Well, I haven't quite finished where I've got to, because my father decided, although he wasn't particularly well paid, he was better paid than the people in the factories that had closed. Obviously, they were on the dole, 7 and 6 a week. And they used to go out into the countryside catching rabbits to augment their food. But my father decided that perhaps I ought to go to the grammar school. In those days, the grammar schools were rather like independent schools today. You had to pay to go. There were one or two scholarships, but they were fairly rare. Because of my checkered background, I didn't really qualify. Equally, my father wouldn't have qualified because he earned too much money, even though he didn't have a very big wage. So I went to the grammar school as a fee-paying student. The fees at that time were a remarkable £2.10 a term. That's in old money. But if you try and work out how much this would be now, it wouldn't be a lot. Wages then were depressed. So, as a newcomer, marginally older than some of the children at the grammar school, I went into the second year. The youngest ones went into a first year. The second year was two streams, 2A and 2 Alpha. And I really had my eyes opened to the benefits of education at that time. Granted, I'd had an interesting background, but it was a bit Rousseau-like, hedonistic, running around the countryside, playing cricket, playing football, and helping to cut up the oranges for the rugby teams. If we played rugby in Cone, which was a very upper crust, very unusual, not many people in those days played rugby. So, Cone Grammar School. I did 4 years, year two. At the end of year two, I went into 3A. The school was unashamedly streamed. I went into 4A. I went into 5A, whereupon I took my school certificate. And on the basis of my school certificate, I got a bursary. I did well. I got a matriculation, which was meant that you had to get at least 5 credits, one in maths and one in English included, and one in a foreign language. I got more than that, and I then went into the sixth form. In the sixth form, I started off doing pure and applied mathematics. By this time, World War II had begun.
I'll come back to that. Now, this concentration on mathematics, that was the way you were going, was it?
That was the way I was going.
What was it that interested you about it, or was it just that you were good at it?
In order to get to university, I needed a scholarship. I made these decisions. Nobody told me about them. I made them myself. And we had a very good and exceptional maths teacher called George Calloway. He ran the rugby, so I was interested in George because of that. He also ran the cricket. In other words, he was a good bloke. He was also a communist, which also interested me at that time, because we believed in, rather naively, in égalité, and we thought communism was equality for all people. So we were idealistic. We used to go for long walks up into the Pennines, and I can say a little more about the country aspect of Cone, where we used to go, what we used to do, swim in the lakes.
We were on maths for a
while. Yes, I know. But Calloway used to come out with us. And we took him down a pothole. That's what young lads did in those days. Take your teacher down a pothole and bring him back alive. Calloway, sadly, left Cone Grammar School in my first year in the sixth and joined the RAF. He became a meteorologist. Later on, he became a mathematical tutor at Cambridge University. I realised, with clarity, that if I needed a scholarship, the other teachers doing the maths, or who would do the maths and the physics and the chemistry, were not up to getting me where I wanted. I switched immediately in my first year in the sixth form then from maths to history, geography, French and English. This was on my own volition. And to cut a long story short, I went through that course and got the scholarship. There was only one available at that time for university, and I got it because I did extremely well in history and in geography. It was rather remarkable why I didn't do quite so well in geography as in history, because the geography teacher left in my second year. However, having burnt my boats, I soldiered on teaching myself geography.
And when did you finish at Cone Grammar School?
I finished in the summer of 1943.
So let's backtrack now and to the thing. What do you remember about the outbreak of war? Were you aware of its approach? You'd be quite young then, you'd be about 15.
I was younger than that, actually.
14?
Yeah.
What do you remember of your feelings? Were you aware of what was going on in Germany and the rest of it?
I grew up in the aftermath of World War One. I talked with people who had come back gassed. My wife's uncle was a strapping young lad, went off to war and came back as a shambles. He had been gassed with mustard gas. His lungs had been rotten. And eventually he died. I knew him very, very slightly. All I can remember is that he was coughing a lot. But we met people like that. Also, wherever you went, there were relics. There were photographs in people's houses of those who had died. There were live shells in people's houses. We had a shell case, we had a mine horn, because my father had been in the Royal Navy also. He was on a minesweeper in the Dover Patrol in 1917, 1918, and 1919 when the war was over. Obviously, they were still sweeping mines. He brought some of these things back, and I grew up in an atmosphere of war. As children, we used to march, and we had bayonets. We had guns, rather rusty, but nonetheless, scrap heaps had guns on them. They'd been disabled, but nonetheless, you could go to a local scrap heap and find yourself a gun, which could never be activated, but nonetheless was useful for drill. So we learned how to drill. And one of the lads in my town, Thomas Metcalf, was very keen on all this. And we used to dig trenches. So if we had nothing to do in the evenings, we would go out on a summer's night and dig a trench, then cover it over with corrugated iron, put turf on top. So I was quite knowledgeable on how to dig a trench, how to march. We all had flags, and on Empire Day we used to put the flags out, and we used to have gala days when people marched. And so there was a semi-militaristic atmosphere in which I grew up. It's difficult now, even with all the media and all the media coverage, to actually convey to children the knowledge that we had of military matters.
What I was asking you is whether you were aware of what was going on in Germany.
The first time I became aware of the threat of fascism was prior to the Spanish Civil War. And we had the Mosleyites, we had black shirts, and we had a rather an effete young man in our area who used to wear a black shirt and used to go to these rallies. I became aware of Mosley. I read the paper. My father was quite an active reader of the paper. We got the Daily Herald because he was essentially a socialist. And we went to meetings, and I grew up in a town, Cone, which was a conservative town, but shared with Nelson, which was a communist town. An MP, Linton Thorpe, who was a conservative, soon to be replaced by Sidney Silverman. I was aware then of many things that were going on. So I became aware of black shirts, I became aware of the Spanish Civil War, I knew of Guernica, I knew of the Reds, and to us...
But not Nazi Germany.
I knew of the German involvement and the Italian involvement, and I also knew that while the Russians pretended to be involved with Catalonia, with Barcelona, with that area, they weren't really. And I knew of the International Brigade, and I knew of people who actually went to Spain.
It was more that, in a sense, your eyes were misdirected from the real threat of Germany, and you saw what was going on in Spain.
We had in Cone, during the Depression, we had a German firm that came to Cone, and one of the members of this firm lived in the street in which I lived. We all lived in streets in those days. There were very few semi-detached houses. You either lived in a mansion or in a street. A mill owner would live in a street. And this German family, and I can't remember their name now, but the little boy, everybody said, oh, he's a real Hun. And he would say, if I saw you in Germany, I would shoot you. That's what he would say to us as little boys. So we did become aware of the German involvement. We also became aware of Adolf Hitler, the rise of Hitler, and we became aware in the 1938 of the Munich crisis. And my first really formative period with regard to the Germans was from that time. And I was aware, I listened to Neville Chamberlain, I saw the film reels in the cinemas because that was our TV in those days. And when he waved his piece of paper, Peace in Our Time, we all knew as kids, because we'd grown up in an area where kids were able to look after themselves. We were streetwise. When I went to the grammar school, I used to have to go through another area where, without rancor, there were Catholics, and they used to go to their school, and they used to want to fight me every day. There were fair dues. There was a lad called Bernard O'Connor who said, you're only going to fight one at a time. So I would come home, and it was a point of honour for me not to go round the other way, the long way round to school. I would go past the short way. I wasn't going to be deflected. And when I met this posse of Catholics, they would bring one lad out, and I would just whack him on the nose. He would retire crying, bleeding, and with snot and blood all over the place. That happened quite regularly. So we got on later, and Thomas Metcalfe, who I spoke about earlier, he was the one who trained us into being soldiers. He was a Catholic, but nonetheless, there is another sad story to Thomas later on, which I will come to.
Now, what about the actual outbreak of war? What do you recall of that? Where were you? Did you hear the broadcast?
I heard the broadcast. I heard the gasp of my mother, and I heard the people looking saw the people looking worried. Oh, they said, not another war. But we felt that the build-up from the Munich crisis to 1939 was sufficient to make us fully aware of the implications. For example, there was a scheme to send young people to the colonies to save the stock, I suppose. And I said, I'll go to New Zealand. I still got the vaccination mark on my left shoulder. I never did get to New Zealand. because the scheme was disbanded when I think it was the Athenia was sunk. But I was quite prepared to go, and some of the lads from my school did actually go away. Some went to Australia. Donald Mitchell went to Australia, and the headmaster's son, equally called Phillips, went to Australia. So when it is said, what were you aware of? We were fully aware of the Munich crisis, the build-up to World War II, the munition, I suppose we were arming ourselves rather belatedly. We were aware of the Spitfires. We were aware of the country becoming geared up for war. And my two brothers, being older, they both applied to go into the forces, and they were both rejected because they too worked on the railway. They were never allowed to leave the railway. So when war came, we knew of the ultimatums, we knew of Poland, we knew of the crises, we knew of the Sudetenland, we knew of the German Anschluss, we knew of these things. We were alert. And I reckon that today I'd be most surprised if kids knew as much and were as politically aware as we were. My granddaughters are not. They might know how to have a stud put in their nose, but they wouldn't know the implications of shellfire.
So what effect did the war have on you at school?
Initially, we turned two. And the first real memory of war that I have when the war had begun was filling sandbags, volunteering to fill sandbags to protect the windows of the Christina Hartley maternity home, which was not far from where I lived. Cologne was a small, compact place. And we joined in Dig for Victory. And in the early days, the allotments were rather pathetic. But as the war moved on, we went on farm camps. I also...
Now, what would a typical farm camp be like then? Tell us what we'd do.
Well, we went to one camp near Garstang and met a man who said, I'm called King Duck. It was a duck farm. And he got more ducks than anywhere else. He also said, I'm a millionaire. That's how he met us. And he said, but I've now turned over a lot of my farm to growing peas, to growing vegetable crops, and particularly tomatoes. And what I want you lads to do is, first of all, put your tents up. Here are some ex-army tents from World War I. You can stick these up. We went with the headmaster, we went by train, and we cycled the last bit to this site. But we put the tents up, and next day we got stuck in. We had it was